You're listening to Talk the Rock with your host, Kayla DeRoche. Today we're going to do a segment focused on domestic violence awareness because it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we have two people to talk with us today about this. Why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves?
Okay, the oldest go first.
Yeah.
All right, my name is Beth Davis. I am the outreach coordinator for our local women's shelter, which is called the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center. And my partner here in crime is?
I'm Sabrina Brown, and I'm currently part-time associate professor at the University of Kentucky and split my time there and in Alaska. And both of those states participate in the National Violent Death Reporting System, which is funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And very comparable, the two states, actually, in regard to intimate partner violence. So I'm splitting my time between Alaska and Kentucky for this month.
All right. So before we get into particulars, why don't we speak a little bit about why we have something like Domestic Violence Awareness Month? Like, what is the purpose of that?
Well, I think the purpose is to make people aware. So, and there are many hot topics out there. There's breast awareness, there's cancer awareness, there's animal cruelty awareness, there's all kinds of different disease awarenesses. So we, for October nationally, they decided that this would be a good month for different groups who are involved in this in preventing and supporting the victims of, to make people more aware, not just in their community, just not in their neighborhood, and just not in their state, but actually in every state in the U.S. And so they chose, and I'm not sure who was the guy that put that month together.
I'm not sure either.
All right. Someone will probably call in and tell us.
Yes, that'd be nice.
Well, if you want to call in, you can call 907-486-3181. And for listeners out there, one of the reasons we have a month like this is to build awareness and to talk about it, because sometimes people may not be aware they're in a relationship that is abusive, mm-hmm. or that they actually may be abusive themselves even. Yeah. So you need to talk about it to kind of figure out what that means. What is abuse? Because it's not just physical. Like, when you think domestic violence, you think of a girl with a black eye or something, and mm-hmm. it's not always that obvious. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. You're absolutely right. A black eye is not a sign of abuse. She could truly have fallen. but there are other types of abuse, and let's just clarify by saying what the word abuse means, because a lot of people use that freely and more freely than they have understanding for. So in domestic violence, what we consider abuse is when someone is exercising control over another person, and that particular control has developed into a pattern of control where it might circle around the whole day, where it may be escalating in the evening when the spouse comes home, when the partner comes home, or may escalate in the weekends after visiting with friends, or may escalate around families, family times, or it just might escalate as soon as other scenarios happen that will trigger those things. But it's whenever you've got a pattern, and in a relationship, that usually happens a lot, and people just sometimes need some help in recognizing that cycle, because often they're so busy walking on eggshells, they don't realize that there's actually a pattern to it.
And that's part of it, living in chaos, just keeping the victim in chaos so they don't have time to reflect or to really communicate with other people outside of that particular person. And from the public health perspective, because we come at this from different areas, advocacy and then kind of more of a research side of things, as a public health professional, we look at points of contact with the victims, because they're not necessarily going to identify it in themselves, like Beth said, and go seek help themselves. So we mm-hmm. have to rely on professionals that can identify it for the victim. And what we look at are medical communities, law enforcement, and courts. Those are the areas that are going to touch families when they become in a critical state or out of control in a chaotic environment. And so I also authored a book entitled I Married a Sociopath, and I was was married to a sociopath for 20 years. And concurrently, I was researching the topic for 10 years of that 20 years and did not realize that I myself was a victim. I would sit on panels and feel nauseous. And I didn't understand because it was control. It was psychological abuse. And then other victims in writing this book and blogging for 5 years have come to me and said, I wish he had hit me. Because then it would have proven to myself, it would have proven to others, kind of the CSI effect where, oh, now I have evidence. And you live with it. Actually, the worst part for me was, and I detail this in my book because it's so subtle, can be so subtle, but the psychological, the gaslighting, making the victim think that they're crazy, projecting what they're doing, but blaming the victim. Those are all very difficult to delineate in your own mind as a victim. So I kind of straddle both as a researcher and a victim. And I welcome, you know, workshops and trainings and use my actual life story as a case study on how to do it right and how to do it wrong, and including myself. I made a lot of errors in trying to leave the relationship. It's very difficult to leave.
Mm-hmm. And as an advocate too, we are about helping us recognize that the question that is often asked in the community is, why doesn't she leave? I'd like to turn that around and actually have the community start asking the question, why does he do that? Because that puts the onus on the woman to leave the relationship, and the statistics are pretty high to show that that's the most dangerous time in the relationship for her life and her children's lives. Is that time when she's pulling away from his control, and he's recognizing that, and he starts to think about doing more difficult, dangerous things to keep her in the home and under his control.
And Beth pointed out that this is a national issue when we began this conversation, and I participated in a study of homicides followed by suicides, and those are very very laden with domestic violence issues. And when the victim tries to leave, that becomes the most important and critical time to protect the children. Because if you think about it, what's the worst form of abuse that the perpetrator would inflict on their victim? In custody cases, they'd try to take the children completely from them. And in the worst case scenario, they're going to kill the children, blame it on the spouse to have them live with that the rest of their lives. And we find that, unfortunately, that is a common theme with homicides followed by suicides across the
mm-hmm.
nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and often when our first-time responders respond to calls for domestic violence in the homes, it sometimes can be very difficult for them to know exactly what's going on. And often in that situation, the tip of the iceberg has been reached and the woman lashes out at the man, either in self-defense or just she's just totally had it, and the police show up and she has a frying pan in her hand,
right.
And without any questions asked, they will often arrest her. However, I'm really happy to say, with our experience here, especially in Kodiak, we just have a great team of first-time responders, and we have all spent a lot of time as a community training each other to recognize what the truth is behind the scene, and to encourage one another to come at it from looking at it with different lenses and not just taking for granted what you see with your eyes. So as a resource center, we have provided many trainings to our first-time responders and our community providers to help them recognize what domestic violence really is. And it's not the first time they get called. That is not the first time that that has actually happened, that conflict has happened. It's probably been squished right to the top, and it's just like a balloon burst. But there's probably a lot of history and time prior to that event happening. And as we are able to put it out there and help people understand what domestic violence looks like, then more people in the community respond to these families are recognizing, wait a minute, we know that this is not a first time. You know, we need to ask more questions and we need to look into it a bit more carefully.
Absolutely. And another thing to consider, it's an emerging topic, and I think it's very important. We look at obesity, smoking, substance abuse, suicidal ideation in and of itself as areas where we need to focus on. But often in these cases, there's something called adverse childhood experiences, where a person has experienced child abuse, psychological, divorce, sexual, and, you know, all of those types of abuse hold different weights for the child as they grow into adolescence and adulthood, but that really contributes to the risk of falling into a relationship where there's domestic violence, because that child has learned to devalue themselves and to give without question. And their purpose in life is to make everyone else comfortable around them and putting their needs second or last or never. And this is a really important topic, because as we look at a woman that's maybe presenting in an emergency department with a substance abuse problem or alcohol abuse problem and suicidal ideation, we need to start asking the questions about domestic violence carefully and drawing that information out, because that needs to be addressed either prior to those other issues or alongside those issues in order to really solve those problems. And we find the more adverse childhood experiences a child has, the more at risk they are for public health issues and especially domestic violence. And that was my story. I lived a life of severe child abuse, sexual abuse in my childhood. And but the hardest part is having to then engage with those family members following the abuse and to actually be told to give them a kiss goodbye. And that just contributed really severely to me devaluing myself as a person. So if you don't mind, I'd just like to read an excerpt from my book that will give an example of what Beth was very clearly talking about. It's chapter 20. And just a little background, I was getting my doctorate, so I was building self-efficacy, which is something Alfred Bandura came up with, and it's the ability that you believe you have the ability to make change in your own life, and that was building inside of me, and I was starting to receive affirmations from other people. So as Beth said, these cycles continue over and over again, but this time the cycle was different for me. So chapter 20, everything is my fault, even the abuse. The argument ended with him dragging me around the house by my feet, straddling me, choking me, and growling, degrading, and belittling statements inches from my face. I was in bad shape, crying, yelling, and fighting back. This time, however, I called the police. He woke my oldest daughter out of bed, she was about 10, 11 at the time, and brought her downstairs. He grabbed my face and told her to look at me and to notice how out of control and emotional I was. He told her to look at him and to notice how calm he was. He went on to tell her that her mother was disturbed and crazy, and that he had no choice but to restrain me in order to protect himself. All the while, he asked her to nod to show him she understood. Of course, the abuser is fine. He/she controls and abuses the other person while remaining calm and stress-free. Meanwhile, the victim is unheard, controlled, scared, upset, and traumatized. The victim is the one who appears to present the problem, mm-hmm. as I did here.
Mm-hmm. And that's really, really difficult when you have such a crazy person that exhibits that kind of craziness. The question is... The belief is that she must have set him off, because on the outside, he's a perfectly normal guy. So the only dynamic that changes that is that relationship with that woman. And then that is how it is perceived from the outside, that somehow she's a problem. And he will make it about her from the outside. He will say that I have this crazy woman. So when people say, you know, how much control is really going on? Well, he can control himself fine when he's outside the house and in his job and in his line of work. And with that particular relationship, he is totally out of control. And so it's unbelievable. And it's really hard for victims to come forward and say, this is what actually happened, because they can hardly believe it themselves. And not only that, they're not really sure if someone else is going to believe them, because it's so crazy making.
So we got a question from a caller. Pam just handed this to me. How does domestic violence look to first responders when a male is the victim?
Well, there's a lot of things to look at when you are looking at a situation. Like I say, If you're responding to a call and they're both involved in fighting with each other, how is anyone going to know until you take them aside, both of them aside, to separate places and talk to them? And that's what our KPD and Alaska State Troopers do. They're good at that. They know how to approach these situations, and so it is hard to know, and it's confusing until you look at the facts and ask the questions. You can't make a fast judgment call in this situation.
And we talk about false allegations a lot as well, because that really diminishes the stories of the real victims. And often the false allegations are the woman that is the abuser and blaming the man for abusing the woman. And just the sheer physicality of a man, we kind of, I know I do, I find myself thinking, well, that's not as big a deal if he gets hit in the face or gets smacked with something. That's not as big a deal because they can handle the abuse more. They should be able to handle. But that's not the case. The abuse is abuse. And just the kind of the female dynamic that we experience in our life, where the man is kind of seen more as the protector, it's very difficult to kind of turn that around, and the woman can almost use her femininity and make it actually worse and really turn the situation around. And the two flags that we kind of look for in research, and then as part of my life experiences, a victim will not go after the perpetrator, like in a court or in a situation. They will act more defensively. So that's something to look mm-hmm. for with first responders, is a defensive posture, not an aggressive posture. And then the other red flag is the victim is kind of more resident about the abuse. They don't have a typical polished story. Mm-hmm. It comes out in bits and pieces and may be confusing mm-hmm. and chaotic, whereas a person that is the real perpetrator might have a more polished story, appear just more mm-hmm. together. If you want to expand on that,
you've said it right. But for the caller who made this call, if you are in that position where you are being abused by the woman, that's not going to be thought of any less because you are the guy. And I want you to feel free to call us at our local shelter and ask to talk to someone if you are experiencing that. Or if you know someone who is experiencing that, please get on the phone and talk to someone, and let us help you as much as we can.
Yeah, that was the second question, is what resources are available to male victims on the island?
Just like female victims, even though it's called Kodiak Women's Resource Center, we also provide services for men too. And so please call us at 486-6171 and ask to speak to an advocate, and they will go ahead and take your call.
Another item that maybe we could talk about is something called parent alienation syndrome, which is not a diagnosis in the psychological diagnostic manual. However, it is becoming more and more well known with perpetrators and victims and families with domestic violence, that the perpetrator will alienate the children against the actual victim, and the victim will lose their children. So that's something that prevents, you know, a person from leaving a relationship, is the threat that their children will be taken from them. In my case, I lost two children to parent alienation syndrome.
And that's, yeah, that I just can't imagine that. But there is more of that out there than we realize. In fact, for at the end of this month, we are having another author coming into town, and her book is called Pieces of Me. And she is based in Anchorage, and she's coming to talk about her experience where her two girls were abducted by her husband and taken to Greece. She had a great community response. They rallied around her and were able to get the two girls back with her today. So she's coming to share her story, and that is on the 27th? That is the last Friday, and then the 28th, the following day, that's going to be at 2:00 at the public library. For anyone else who's interested in talking to another author about their experiences and bringing to the table more conversations about domestic violence.
So maybe it's sometimes hard for people who experience abuse to identify when it becomes abuse versus a tiff or a fight. What do you tell people who feel that their partner is doing them an injustice, like manipulating them? What do you tell them to look for? Like, how can they identify their own situation?
Well, they don't need much. They don't need, you just need to get them talking. And as they start sharing, and if they have a safe platform in which to share, you usually find that they really do know already. And that often, as in talking it out with someone who's good at listening, that they will start recognizing and put two and two together. And it will take sometimes another person to help them put the jigsaw pieces together, right, Sabrina?
A kind person, yeah. An understanding, not judgmental approach is very helpful, because there's already enough shame, and then the victim is sometimes engaging in self-destructive behaviors, and there's that just compiles the shame, and that's used against them as well. And so an understanding, non-judgmental person is the best approach. And perpetrators don't show themselves 100%. What they do is they test their limits. So they'll go a little bit, mm-hmm. see how much the victim will take, and then go a little further. And even if the police are called, they'll see how manipulative they can be with the police and just continue to escalate. So that's there are red flags, I believe, from the beginning, and usually it, always,
and,
don't you think?
And it is a game for them, too, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. They are very much in control of themselves and of their feelings. They really are. That's why we're having this subject, because it's a very hard it's a very been a very hidden one for very, you know, for a very long time, and it still is hidden. And depending on the society and the community, you know, whether you're in a patriarchal society or you live in a matriarchal society, how the community looks at your relationship and defines it will depend on that flavor of that community.
Mm-hmm. So, Sabrina, looking at your own relationship, what was the process for you in that realization period, moving from, okay, this is a situation I need to exit from, to having exited the situation?
That's a really good question. And I had people in my life. So because I worked in violence prevention and homicide suicides, I interact with the crime lab director, and she took me up to the lab one day. And I think you have to be ready to hear it too. And I guess at that time I was ready to hear it. She said, "I want to know what he offers you, what he contributes to the relationship." And I couldn't think of one thing. He didn't work. I was a human ATM machine just on a treadmill and just keeping me in chaos. And she said that woman just died of domestic violence, and that's her. We're running the DNA, and that's going to be you in a very short period of time, I would guess about 6 months. And then I had another friend that kind of alluded to the same sort of situation that started to occur to me. And then when I called the police, and then I started to realize I do have rights, and I decided to leave, and they can sense that. As soon as you pull back emotionally, they jump on you, and that's when my physical abuse started to happen. It escalated when I started to detach emotionally. They feel that. And so I finally got him out of the house, and he started to call the police and use services against me to turn it that I was mm-hmm. the abuser. And I'm trying to get the story straight. He said to me the next day, "I will come and go into this house as I please," after I'd already kicked him out. And so I went and filed an EPO, an emergency protective order, because I said, I just want my home environment safe. I didn't involve the children. I didn't involve our work environment. I just wanted to be able to sleep at night. And so that's when everything hit the fan, and I was served a 35-page motion, and we entered the court system because I had dared to cross him. That was his line. And I sat in court, and any humiliating event that ever could have happened to me was in that motion, 35 pages, because they wanted a reaction. They wanted me to break down. And I didn't. I knew I couldn't. And I asked for a week, and then I left the courtroom, and a domestic violence advocate, probably someone just like Beth, pulled me into a room and said, "You can't leave at the same time as him. You're in a violent situation." And I said, "No, I'm not. We have problems, but it's not violent." And that was after I had already been beaten physically. Mm-hmm. And she said, "No, you're in one of the most violent relationships I've ever experienced, and you need to find a good lawyer, and, you know, we're going to help you," which became a web of an interesting year of my life, which you can read about further. But that particular moment, it occurred to me, oh, I'm in a violent situation. And then when there was a situation where our 6-year-old son was hysterical, and I asked him for 10 minutes to rock him, take care of him, to calm him before the custody exchange. And he said, "That means nothing to me. I'll make sure that you pay for that if he's not there on time." Then I realized I was dealing with a sociopath, not just abuser, but someone without conscience.
It does take a long time to recognize that something's not right there. And healthy boundaries is really, really important in all relationships. I mean, for a relationship to be healthy, you have to have really good boundaries. And I have a support group I'm leading on Monday nights at the Women's Resource Center, where we are talking and addressing what a healthy boundary looks like. And, you know, a lot of women in these domestic violence situations really don't know where they begin and where they end for as a person. And that identity for them has disappeared a long time ago. And it is really hard to believe that I should be able to do this. I should be able to do that. And they found they can't. They don't have any edges to stand on because they are so just like, I don't know, protoplasm or something. They've just got no edge, like an amoeba with no edge to it. It just flows over everything and covers everything. And it does take a family, or it takes a moment with an advocate, or a moment with another friend who says, you know, this is just not right. This and this and this is happening. And sometimes it takes more than that.
Well, it looks like we just have a few minutes left. What are the resources out there, again, just for those who may need them?
Well, for here in Kodiak, we do have the Kodiak Women's Resource Center. And we have a lot of resources there. We have a Tagalog-speaking advocate, and we have a Spanish-speaking advocate. We also provide legal services, legal advocacy. We are a resource center, so that means that if we don't have the resources, we'll find the resources for you and help you. We also have emergency funding to help women and children come from the different smaller villages around Kodiak to actually fly into Kodiak and come and stay with us. And then we have emergency resources where we can fly them out of Kodiak to another part of the United States where they have family who's willing to support them. So we have those fundings, and then we also have our shelter, which is a 25-bed shelter. And we have emergency, legal, but we have medical advocacy too. We also have a sexual response team. And one of the main differences for how things used to be done, and I'm so glad that we have this now, when you have someone who's been sexually assaulted or raped, we have a team of people come together under one roof, and we have one interview with that one person, and it is not repeated over and over again.